Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Patrick Pufuma is back again to interview a new person for the EMID podcast series. This time it is Dr. Michael Silverman, who is the chair of infectious diseases at Western University. This is located in Canada. And he had some really interesting research that caught Patrick's eye, which is why he wanted to dive into this. Now, I understand there's a lot going on with COVID-19, and the last couple of podcasts have been dedicated to that. However, I wanted to switch gears and talk about a different infectious disease. Then we'll go back to our other podcast per normal, barring anything that significantly changes. But I thought this was a great one to bring up. Patrick was able to interview him to keep our monthly EMID podcast series going on. I hope you enjoy it. It is a little bit longer, but that was because all the content was so great, I could not figure out a way to break it up and still have all of the good information that I like to have in a single podcast. So we've wrapped it all up at the same time. Hopefully that works still, but let's get into it.
I'm here at Western University in London, Ontario. It's about 2 hours west of Toronto. And we've been hit real hard with the opiate epidemic. So like a lot of mid-sized towns, like we're about just over 400,000, so about the size of New Orleans, we've been hit particularly hard. Some of the major cities weren't hit quite as hard per capita as the rural areas and the smaller cities. So we're a regional referral center, and we've got a very large university here, but our community has a very large number of people who inject drugs. And predominantly, I mean, there's a lot of opiates. There's a fair bit of crystal meth being used. The opiate of choice was hydromorphone. So hydromorphone, which is controlled release. And the reason why it's so popular, I mean, it's gone from being an unpopular opiate to being, it became the dominant one being prescribed in Canada, because oxycodone controlled release, but a lot of people were getting addicted to opiates because of the large amount of prescribing that was going on. It was felt to be relatively safe. It was felt not to induce addiction. And as we all unfortunately know now, that ended up not being true. So a lot of people got addicted to it. So because of that, the approach in Canada was to remove the drug from the market. It's still on the market in the United States, but it was removed from the market in Canada with the hope that this would reduce the number of people who would get addicted to drugs. And what was replaced was what's called Oxy-Neo, which was supposed to be a tamper-resistant preparation that would be hard to inject. And indeed, it is hard to inject. You got to put things in a microwave. You got to heat shock it, and then in the microwave, then add water quickly. It's not easy to do, and especially if you're homeless and stuff, you don't necessarily get access to a microwave. And even so, it's not easy to do. So the thought was, but we'd switch to oral the Oxy-Neo. But what ended up happening is people switched over to hydromorphone. And hydromorphone was felt to be safer in that it had a lower incidence of drug overdose. But what we found was that people were injecting this drug, and they were injecting it extensively. And it's become almost 50% of all prescriptions for opioids, in fact, slightly above 50% across Canada. So it's a huge thing. And there's the content, there's the controlled release, and there's the immediate release. And I'm getting into these details because they sound kind of esoteric, but they actually end up being kind of central to the story. So controlled release, the idea is controlled release is supposed to give you less opportunities for addiction, in that, it's good for people with cancer. It gives pain relief slowly over 12 hours. You only have to take it every 12 hours, so you don't get rapid withdrawal and then drug-seeking activity. But of course, when you inject it, that whole controlled release issue doesn't work, because it's just, you get it right away. You get the hit right away. The controlled release is supposed to be in the intestines, where it's dissolved slowly. So people started injecting this stuff, and it was so popular, and it remains very popular, that it's extremely expensive on the street. Now, there's no real labs that make this. It's not easy to make. So it's all from pharmaceutical grade. It's all, you know, it's from people getting prescriptions and diversion or direct prescriptions. And they inject this stuff, but it's so popular, it's around $60 Canadian. So that'd be around $45 US per capsule on the street. And that's, it's got a large dose. And because it's controlled release, what you do is you open up the capsule, you pour the beads into some type of container so you can crush them. So people will use it, buy a pill crusher from a local drugstore, or they'll take a cigarette lighter or a lipstick container to try to crush it. Then you add water to it. So they do this, and then they add water, and it dissolves, a little bit of it dissolves, and then they suck it up with a syringe. But because it's still really, it like leaves a thick slurry, it's not easily dissolved because it's controlled release. It's made to dissolve slowly. So you got to stick a filter, which is like some people use the end cigarette filter. The public health actually gives out these little filters that are little discs, small discs that you can stick your needle into. And so you can suck it up and the needle doesn't get blocked. And it's supposed to take out the large particles that would otherwise block the needle and maybe harm you because they're large particles. So all this makes sense. But then after, you know, there's a lot of drug left behind. And we actually looked in the lab. Patients were telling us, oh, yeah, we get washes. So you add another more water and you draw back and you get another hit. And then you add more water and you get another hit because it's being dissolved slowly. And if they're 24 milligrams, well, that's a lot of the opiate in a capsule. And each hit, you know, you get about half of the remaining drug. So as the number of washes you do, the amount of drug you get goes down, but depends on how desperate people are. And if they're in withdrawal, they'll keep doing it. Many people do 7-8 washes, and they might save the stuff for later. They might save it for the next day or for a couple hours later. They share it because it's $60 a capsule. People will often say, well, I don't have $60, but I got 30. I'll get the first two hits. You come in with 10, you got 20, you'll get the third hit. He's only got 10, he'll get the fourth hit, the fourth wash. So because each wash is, you know, it has less and less drug. Many people will say, well, my grandmother, she got the prescription from the doc. So she gets the first two washes. And then she gives me the third or the fourth wash. Or some prostitutes will pay the pimps and say, well, you know what? I owe you $15. You can have my third and fourth washes. But what they do is they take a needle, they stick it in, they suck the stuff back, they stick it in their arm. Then they take that needle and they say, well, are you sharing needles? Of course not. I would never share needles. But they put the needle back in the same filter, water, and they mix it around. And then they take it out and put it in their arm again. And then they put it back in again. And then they give it to somebody else who puts their needle into the same filter that's now had the first guy's needle in it that's been contaminated with blood. And they're often using the needle tip to mix everything around, to try to mix the slurry, to try to get it to dissolve more. Because of this, we wondered, now we then experienced an HIV outbreak in our area, quite a severe HIV outbreak, and amongst people who inject drugs. And this was quite a mystery because, as you know, there was a big HIV outbreak in Indiana, in Scott County, Indiana. Mike Pence was governor at the time. And at the time, people said, okay, this makes sense why this would happen in Indiana. There was no needle exchange. So there was no needle distribution. They made that illegal. The, you know, opiate substitution therapy, methadone and Suboxone were very limited, and there were almost no prescribers. And there was no HIV clinic, no local HIV clinic. And so people weren't getting on antiretrovirals when they were and so they would remain with high viral loads and transmit. So that makes sense. So we had it here, and you say, okay, well, yeah, it must be because, well, you don't have a needle exchange program. Well, we actually have the largest needle exchange program in Canada per capita and one of the largest in the world before our epidemic started. So for our population of just over 400,000, they were giving out over 2 million needles a year. So that's for the total population. And of course, not everybody's injecting drugs, but if there's an estimated 6,000 people injecting drugs and you're giving out 2 million and then they ramped it up to 3 million and we were still having very large, a very large HIV outbreak, which was, it didn't make sense. And so, and then we had, we were in the top quartile in methadone prescriptions in the province. And we have a local academic HIV clinic, which was multidisciplinary, and we have free access to antiretrovirals in our system. So for the vast majority of people, it's free, and other people, you know, with some forms, you can get it covered. So why would we get an HIV outbreak? And then we came up with this idea, could it be because people are sharing the washes? And indeed, that's what we found. We did a case control trial, and we found that people who shared washes from with their hydromorph were 22 times more likely to get HIV than people who didn't. And that sharing needles was very rare because there were so many needles on the street. And so if it's because of the washes getting contaminated by people sticking their needles in, you say, well, okay, tell people not to share their washes. Well, that's not going to work. It's $60 a capsule. There's $24 worth of drug left in. Tell them just to throw it out. That's not going to happen. So, you know, people who are wealthy don't throw $24 in the garbage. People who are on social assistance and living homeless for sure are not going to throw $24 in the garbage, especially when you're withdrawal and you need that. So we came up with the idea that you should cook your wash. So you take a cigarette lighter and you heat it, and it boils the water just until it bubbles. And we showed that that decreased the amount of HIV by 99% when we contaminated it on purpose with HIV and then did that. And so, and it didn't increase or decrease the amount of drug that came out of solution. And you say, well, you know, a lot of people didn't do it before we started this because there was a myth that it boils off the dope. You don't want to heat it. Like you heat heroin because you got to do that to dissolve it. You often have to heat cocaine to dissolve it. But nobody would heat hydromorph because they said, well, it's going to boil off the dope. So we actually did testing in the lab and showed, no, it's like boiling salt water. The water comes off, but you still got the same amount of salt at the bottom.
How did you convince the population that was the case, or was it not really even an issue?
Oh, it was an issue. We had to show people that we did the test. We showed the, you know, we did community education. It was in the newspapers. It was on local TV. It was with the all the needle exchange clinics and all the frontline workers. And then we did education for local users. And we showed them, and we showed them this, and it became widespread that you got to cook your wash. And we gave out free lighters. You know, a lot of people who inject drugs already smoke, but those who didn't, you know, they got free lighters. And sure enough, the HIV epidemic rapidly stopped when we did this. So the number of cases fell precipitously once we did this. So that's how I got interested in how people were injecting and what was happening. And then the issue came up about, and by the way, if this is sharing, could this drove an HIV outbreak? Could it be driving hepatitis C? Because that's also from sharing. And indeed, we just got a paper accepted for publication that we showed across Ontario, across the province, if you look at where the areas have the most new hepatitis C diagnoses, those are the areas that have the most hydromorph content prescriptions. Because hydromorph content has multiple washes and it's shared. And we ask people, you know, the immediate release, do you do washes with that? No, we don't do washes with the immediate release. It comes out right away because there's no second hit. You don't get a wash. And so one other thing that's happened is a lot of the prescribers have switched over from using Contin in people who the controlled release in people they think might be injecting to giving the immediate release to try to prevent this sharing. So, but our region also had very high incidence of endocarditis, and it rapidly rose. And we showed in a previous paper that if you trace the percentage of all opiate prescriptions that were hydromorph content, as that rose, the percentage of people who got admitted to hospital who injected drugs who ended up getting diagnosed with endocarditis also rose. as more and more hydromorph content was on the street, more and more people who inject drugs were getting endocarditis. So it's not just, oh, there's more people who are using opiates. Of those who are injecting opiates, the percentage who end up with endocarditis was going up. And so you say, well, I mean, we showed that actually, and here's where something pretty tricky came in. So one of the things that they use to make this controlled release is called ethyl methyl cellulose, or these various cellulose, different cellulose compounds. And cellulose, you know, it's the stuff in celery, and we don't digest it very well, and it keeps, interestingly, that same stuff is used in viral transport media. When you want to keep a virus alive, you use that. So they put that in viral transport media. And we thought, could this stuff actually be keeping HIV alive in the little cookers? It's like a little pan that you mix the water in and you suck it back. And sure enough, when we spiked it with virus, when we put hydromorph controlled release, the virus lived up to 3 days. And when we didn't, the virus died almost immediately. And when we used the immediate release, the virus died. It's not the opiate that keeps it alive. It's the stuff that makes it controlled release. And that's, but we, even in the presence of the drug, when you heat it with a cigarette lighter, that kills the virus.
Have you seen that with other extended releases, or is it much more pronounced with hydromorph?
Well, we haven't had the ability to test. We would like to test Opana, because that was, of course, the drug that caused the epidemic in Indiana. And Opana has the same drug excipients as hydromorph content does to make it slow release. So we think that this stuff, and if you look at the, you know, I've gone into the chat rooms of people who inject drugs just to see what they're talking about. You know, there's Opana chat rooms, and everybody talks about getting multiple washes and sharing washes. And so they were sharing washes, and the CDC has now, you know, described this. But Opana has also these cellulose components in it to make it slow release. And Cadian, which is also long-acting morphine, also has that stuff in it. So we wonder whether Cadian can do it. We haven't tested Cadian in the lab yet, but we hope to. And so this stuff was keeping HIV alive. Now, in order to make this stuff, interestingly, you got to handle it very frequently, because you got to crush it with a cigarette lighter or something, and then you got to add water, and then you put the filter in, and then you add more water, and you're touching it frequent times. But it's got, cellulose is a carbohydrate. Now, humans can't digest cellulose, but many microbes can. And also, to give it its consistency, they add gelatin, which is animal protein, comes from often from pork products, and iron to give it color. Well, that's like a blood agar medium. That's like a culture medium for bacteria. When we want to grow bacteria, we use blood, you know, sheep's blood that we've let to break down, because it's got a lot of iron in it, which microbes really need. It's got proteins and it's got sugars. We thought, could this actually help bacteria grow? And indeed, when we added a Staph aureus, which is the most common cause of endocarditis in people who inject drugs, the Staph aureus would live far longer and survive far better in the presence of hydromorph content than it would with hydromorph immediate release, which actually inhibited the growth, or with OxyContin. OxyContin, the old drug, did not keep Staph aureus alive, but the new one does. And in fact, we got people to give us their used equipment, and this is where they've injected hydromorph content, and said, you know, just, you've done 7 washes or whatever, now you're going to throw it out because it's, you know, you've gotten all the opiate. Just give us the last bit. We'll do one more wash in the lab and squirt it on a plate and see what we grow. And from 14%, and when we do it, it's like doing one more wash. So this is what would happen if you'd inject it into your vein. We squirted it on a plate instead of injecting it into your vein. And 14% of the time, we got Staph aureus grew from, that were alive that grew from this. That means when people are injecting this drug, 14% of the time, they're getting the organism that most commonly causes endocarditis. And And we looked at it in our region. We have, you know, the largest case series, largest number of patients yet reported with endocarditis associated with injection drug use, which shows the extent of the problem that this city with approximately 450,000 can have so many patients because we have so much hydromorph content. And over 70% of all the cases were Staph aureus. Some were MRSA, some were routine Staph aureus, but there's a ton of Staph aureus. And so we wondered, you know, could the hydromorph content actually be driving a lot of the endocarditis? And as I said, when we looked across the province, in Ontario, we're able to do this because we have an integrated network and everybody, because it's socialized medicine, all the diagnoses and the vast majority, like all the billings and all the hospital admissions go into one database. So unlike the U.S., it's harder to study some of these things because you have all these private insurers, then different ones get different information, right? And then the prescriptions have different sources. We have all one source. So we can follow what's happening across the province. We said, okay, if hydromorph content is really doing this, then if someone got a prescription for hydromorph content, they should be more likely to get endocarditis than if they got a prescription for any other opiate, especially if we already know they're an injection drug user. Well, how do we know they're an injection drug user? Well, there's ways to look at administrative databases and get an idea. So for instance, if they've already had a diagnosis of drug abuse, or they've had a diagnosis of addiction, or they've had a diagnosis of hepatitis C, those are all hints that someone's probably been injecting at least at some point. So we took just people who had one of those diagnoses, opiate use or stimulant use, so something to suggest that they were injecting drugs, and said, okay, of them and those who were admitted to hospital, we can look back 3 months earlier or 4 months earlier and see, did they get a prescription for an opiate? And was that opiate hydromorph content? And we found if that opiate was hydromorph content, you were 3.3 times more likely 4 months later to get within 4 months to get admitted with endocarditis than if you had any other opiate. And the vast majority of those were Staph aureus. And we showed that Staph aureus particularly loves living on this stuff. It's not all bacteria. So when we looked at group A strep and other bacteria, that formula that they put in is particular in those drugs are particularly good at keeping Staph aureus alive. But that is one of the most virulent things to get in your blood if you inject it. We also have shown that if you heat the stuff, just like we do with HIV, if you cook your wash, it kills 99% of the Staph aureus, even in the presence of the drug. So if you use a cigarette lighter until it bubbles, it kills 99, you know, it drops the number of organisms by 2 log. So we are hoping that it's going to reduce the number of, that approach will reduce the number of endocarditis, but that will take longer to be able to see. But that's something we're working on now. So it's been a long road. We still have a lot of things to sort out, particularly whether other opiates, long controlled release opiates, are doing this, and whether they have the particular propensity to induce, to keep Staph aureus or other organisms alive, and whether they could explain some of the endocarditis that we're seeing.
There's some grassroots campaigns. It's still very taboo, I think, in the U.S. to do a needle exchange program, or at least to some extent in some regions it is. If a region was to start doing this, it sounds like there's other stumbling blocks that they may encounter. So we talked about the disc filters to have as well, and then it was the Cook Your Wash campaign that you had. What other stumbling blocks would you potentially see if someone was interested in starting up some harm reduction strategy or a needle exchange program? What other things could they try to do to optimize their patient outcomes?
Canada is pretty liberal, so we have a number of things going on here. So we have not just needle exchange, where people bring in 10 needles, they get 10 needles back. We have needle distribution, where you say, I don't know where my needles went. They say, okay, how many you want? Well, I want 100. Okay, you can have 100. So you can have as many as you want, as many as you can hold. And they say, well, what if they're not using it? What if they're giving them to other people? Well, that's fine. We want to get them out there. That's the whole idea, you know. So they're giving it to other people who inject drugs. That's the idea. We want clean needles on the street, not used needles on the street. So we actually do needle distribution. And the other thing we have in Canada, and we have this in London, is supervised injection sites. So places where people can go. They have them in Toronto now. It first started in Vancouver. We had the first one in the eastern part of the country, in London here. And now it's in Ottawa and Toronto and a number of other cities, Montreal, where people can go to inject. And there are medical professionals there so that if someone passes out, someone will jump in and give them Narcan. And they make sure you get free clean needles and clean equipment. And that's helped a lot. And especially since it's a clean environment where people are injecting. And they ask people not to take the equipment back home, because just inject there. And that's helped not to store the stuff for a long time. Because people would take the stuff, and because it gives multiple washes, they put it in their pocket to keep, you know, to keep it safe. But of course, that's like an incubator. That's keeping it at body temperature. So the bacteria live better and can grow. Some people still want to take their stuff because they don't want to waste the drug that's left over. And now they just gave a safe supply. So we have a safe supply system going on here where they say, well, we know you're injecting. We don't want you to have to get into prostitution to get the drugs. We don't want you to have to get into crime to get the drugs. We want you to get drug that we know is not, that has not been adulterated with other stuff. So certain prescribers in a controlled situation are writing prescriptions for Hydromorph, the immediate release, not the controlled release, so that people can get access to that. And that's something that's just getting ramped up. It's been going on a low level for a little while, but it just is likely going to be ramping up very soon. So those are all things that are going on in Canada. The feeling is that probably what makes the most decrease in death rate in terms of overdose is the supervised injection sites, where people can go and inject and know that there's someone there who's watching them. I would say, though, that the big focus of people who inject drugs has been the death rate associated with overdose. But many of the opioids, like Hydromorph content, has a relatively lower, it's not that you can't overdose from it, you clearly can, but it's a little less respiratory suppressant than fentanyl. So our overdose deaths are a little lower than you might expect from the number of people who are injecting. That's not to say some people don't die from overdose. They clearly do. That's why the supervised injection sites are really important, and having enough supplies of naloxone or Narcan. What we found is that a lot of the deaths are associated with infectious complications of injection. So our death rate overall from endocarditis and our death rate from HIV and complications of hepatitis are greater than our death rates from overdose. So focusing only on preventing overdose is not going to stop the deaths associated with the opioid epidemic. And interestingly, most of those deaths don't show up in the statistics, because most coroners, this is true, I believe, in the United States, just like it is in Canada, when someone dies of HIV associated with injection drug use, it's considered an HIV death. It is not considered a death associated with opioids. And if they die of hepatitis C or endocarditis, it's considered natural causes. It is not considered an opioid-related death. So the only numbers we keep track of are overdose and people's, and now those numbers are pretty scary, but and they're very high. But if you look at overall, and some various studies have shown, between 40 and 60% of all deaths associated with opioids are infectious deaths. So just preventing overdose is not going to stop the death rate from the opioid crisis. At most, it's going to get rid of about half of them.
Wow, this is really fascinating. This sounds like many, many, many lives work here. This is amazing how this has all sort of come together, and a really interesting cross-section of, like we were talking about before, behavioral economics and social determinants of health. I can't imagine that a drug company would possibly test their extended release format for, you know, if it carried strep or staph or, fungal infections better than another. I can't imagine that's something that they particularly test for often.
But no, they don't test for it at all. And they say, well, we don't advise people to do that.
Right.
So we're not going to test for how it performs in a way when you're using it in a way we don't recommend. So we just say, don't do it. And so they don't test and don't study it. So we had to study it as an academic lab, but it's not so easy to do. You know, it's not so easy to get access to the to these medications, et cetera, because they're still, you know, controlled. I mean, we would like to study some of these aspects with crystal meth, but that's illegal to possess. So, you know, we would have to get that from the from police or other sources, and that's much harder to get a hold of. And even just getting, when we studied OxyContin, it wasn't so easy because we had to get special, you know, Health Canada, which is your equivalent of the FDA, permission to bring it into the country, to study it, to compare how the old drug would work versus the new one. And we did show that the old one does not keep Staph aureus alive, but the new one does. And the old one dissolves rapidly, the new one does not and leaves multiple washes. So something that was done to try to reduce addiction and was tried to reduce people injecting, paradoxically, may have increased the total number of deaths because there was this unexpected consequence that when people do inject this drug, particularly from an infectious point of view, it seems to be more dangerous. We suspect that led to our HIV epidemic, and we have good data that it led to our epidemic of endocarditis. And endocarditis, people say, well, you know, you give antibiotics, you should fix it. Our data is, and others have found similar things, 33% of people who get endocarditis will die of it. And that's with best care. And then about once you've had endocarditis, it damages your valve. I mean, even if you survive it, pieces break off, you can end up with a stroke, you can end up paralyzed because a piece goes off into your spinal cord. And many people are never the same after they've had endocarditis. And then they've got a damaged valve. Now, once the valve is damaged, almost anything you inject, now, many bacteria, many things, and yeast, particularly fungi, can now stick to your valve. And we showed that once fungi are very uncommon to cause the first episode of endocarditis, but once you've had endocarditis, the second episode's usually on the same valve that was damaged before and often has a yeast on it. So, and those can break off and go to the brain. And it's very hard to treat people who inject drugs when they get yeast on their valves because the medications can interact with that we use for that can interact with methadone. You're supposed to be on medications for life. It's hard for someone who injects drugs to take medications for life, especially medications that can cause drug interactions. If they mix it with fentanyl, it can cause cardiac arrhythmias and sudden death. So it's hard to get these people. And then ideally you do surgery, but once you do surgery and you fix their valves, then those artificial valves can then get infected. So, so surgeons understandably are hesitant. Now we showed from our data that having surgery actually was protective and you're less likely to die. The other thing that we showed is cardiac surgery, and if you have, so that they shouldn't be declined. But they also showed that getting addiction services while you're in hospital with your endocarditis makes you less likely to die. Because at that point, when you're in hospital and you know you might be dying from this, that can often motivate people to change. That's a time when if you approach people, but a lot of hospitals say we don't have addiction services for inpatients, and we'll refer them to that after they go home. Well, after they go home, people have other priorities. They're trying to get the drug. They're dealing with their addictions. But when they're stuck in the hospital and they're on intravenous antibiotics, often that's a time when people, you know, and they're away somewhat from some of the network that's encouraging drug use. That may be a time when people can be approached and may be more able to make changes in their life.
Why do you think that surgical repair leads to a better outcome? Do you think it's just that they don't have a damaged valve? Do you think they're just watched more closely because someone's claiming ownership? What's your hypothesis there?
Well, I think, I mean, now it's a select group that gets surgery. By no means are we suggesting everyone who's had endocarditis should have heart valves, their heart valve replaced. It's only those with the bad valves. Now, when you control for, you know, which organism and which side, you know, because if the infection's on the left side of the heart, that's more dangerous than the right. And whether they've been in the intensive care unit, that's also suggests that they're sicker. So when you control for all those things, still, having surgery is associated with a 50% lower death rate. So we think it's because if you're really sick and your valve is really leaky, it's better to have it fixed than not to have it fixed because you're going to go have heart failure, and having long-term heart failure is a problem. But, you know, I will say that other people say, well, I'm not sure that's true. And it may be related to our region where most of our valve damage is right-sided endocarditis, and other places that have more left-sided endocarditis on the mitral or aortic valves may be a little different. But that's something we're looking into further, and we're doing further studies to try to clarify. But we do not feel that people should be refused surgery out of hand, saying, well, they're an injection drug user, therefore surgery is contraindicated. We feel that the same criteria for surgery in people who don't inject drugs should be used in these people. Now, it's also possible that the surgeons refuse to operate on people who have very severe addictions. So the kind of person who's injecting heavily while they're in hospital, and they, you know, and they say, well, look, I don't want you infecting my new valve that I put in there. Because when you get infection on an artificial valve, it's even more dangerous than when you get an infection on your own valve. So if they think you're very highly likely to get infected, they may refuse surgery. So it's hard to see whether that may have caused some of our signal that we saw that surgery was protective. But we're looking into that further.
Anything else that you feel like we missed?
Yeah, I would emphasize that the infections associated with drug use need more systematic approach to study and their attention. We need to look at various different other opiates. We ideally should look at other drugs that are being injected and study these more carefully, and how people are injecting and what they're doing. I mean, we did a lot of talking, particularly we worked as a team, and a colleague of mine, Sharon Koivu, who's an addiction specialist. There's a number of people who are involved. And surprisingly, people who do this, who inject the drugs, were very, very anxious to tell us the story, would tell us what they're doing. And the details, often they know what the problem is. They would say, you know what, we're doing all these washes. I wonder whether they get dirty. And they would often know, but people would often discount, say, well, you know, they're probably ashamed. They don't want to talk about it. I'm not going to ask too many questions about how they're injecting. I just need to know they're injecting and they got endocarditis and tell them to stop. But when we would start to talk to them, patients would often start, you know, talking to us for a half hour, for an hour about, well, let's go through this. Let me show you how I do it. Do you have any suggestions how we could do it differently? And patients were learning from each other. So they were usually somebody else taught them how to inject, and they do that the way somebody else taught them, and then they go teach the next person. And so a lot of myths can circulate. Don't heat the hydromorph, it'll boil off the dope. And so unless we talk to people and really listen to them and find out what they're doing, it's hard to make interventions. But they often, you know, as long as it's non-judgmental, patients will often want to tell us, and they want to know how they can be kept safe. Many patients are far more scared of getting endocarditis than they are of getting HIV. They say, HIV, you take one tablet once a day, you live, you're fine. Endocarditis, I got a friend, he died. I got another one, he's got a stroke, he's never the same, he's in a wheelchair, he's blind. They're terrified, and with good reason. Endocarditis is a very dangerous disease and has a very high mortality rate. And as I said, you know, a third of people will die from the first episode. About 32% will get a second episode, and then they also will have about 36% chance of dying the second time. We've got many patients who've had five episodes of endocarditis. They keep getting it over and over and over. So how we can stop this, and of course it's extremely expensive for the healthcare system. They require long courses of antibiotics, and usually often intravenous antibiotics, and that's not so easy to do in someone who's injecting drugs. It's a huge clinical problem that we need to look at more systematically.
All right. Well, Dr. Silverman, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. This was fantastic. This was extremely intriguing for me. Definitely a learning experience. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for your interest.
That wraps up this podcast. Thank you both Patrick and Dr. Michael Silverman for coming on to the podcast. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.